Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hello, I'm Angela Yocum. I serve as the Chief Transformation and Digital Officer at Novant Health.
Angela, thanks so much for finding time joining us on the Ivy Podcast on this beautiful Friday afternoon. Tell us a little bit, before we talk a little bit more about the digital and the transformation, a lot of that great stuff that you're currently leading, want to spend a couple of minutes talking about you. Share with us your background, where you come from, kind of high-level career timeline, if you don't mind.
Sure. So background, although my undergraduate degree is in music, I started writing code in sixth grade. So the transition to a master's in computer science eventually was not as abrupt as it might look on paper. And computer science was absolutely the right field for me to study for a couple of reasons. First, it trained me to identify and understand very granular interdependencies in very, very broad contexts, which of course is transferable to so many of the most difficult problems that we have to solve in every field. And second, the advances in technology have enabled some of the most significant societal shifts in the past 20 years. So to be part of that enabling capability set has been an extraordinary journey for me. And so along the way, I had a number of early jobs while I was in school. I worked for a software startup, Slinging Code. I was a large-scale network designer for a large university. I did some DoD multimedia contracting work and really started my career trajectory at IBM in their innovation center in Atlanta. Then I moved to in-house technology leadership roles in a variety of fields, very large companies, global companies, with successfully increasing domain responsibilities.
Well, that's very interesting. Something that definitely stands out, your educational background in music, although your interests and seems like your passions are more on the technical side. Tell us a little bit more about that. How did that come about? And maybe how did the education in music perhaps help or currently helps you in the current role, so the organization that you lead?
Well, music education is a really interesting field. Now, my undergraduate degree is in music performance, and so when we train young performers, one of the things that we train them to do is this idea of developing muscle memory. So when you see these wonderful virtuosos performing on an instrument, for example, they have not only practiced that particular piece that you're hearing them play, they have practiced so many different combinations of notes and little etudes, and they've perfected their muscle memory so that they are almost on autopilot by the time you're hearing them perform. And it's lovely to see. It's very similar, I believe, to what we see in athletics. You don't just see football players, for example, practicing football. You see football players in the gym working on strength training. You see them doing conditioning exercises. Sometimes you see them taking yoga or ballet. And the reason is because they have to become better athletes to be better football players. And similarly, for musicians, you have to be very facile in every aspect of performing with your instrument so that regardless of what the task at hand is, you're able to sound like a virtuoso at every turn. And truly, in life, it's so much the same. So regardless of the field that we study or that we practice, it's important to have an understanding of context. We have to be able to understand how capability sets like those that are enabled by technologies can accelerate our desired outcomes. We have to understand where the world is going, how society is shifting. We have to think about how consumer appetites are shifting. We have to think about, you know, what new business models may emerge in our space. I would go so far as to say that focusing on an industry now is less interesting than perhaps it has always historically been, because the lines between industries are blurring. So how do we train people to study and become experts in a given domain if that domain itself is evolving so rapidly as to be unrecognizable in 5 to 10 years? Well, we have to give that muscle memory that we see in young musicians or young athletes starting to develop. So I think when we think about what it means to be successful in any of our fields, you'll see a lot of those common themes throughout.
Well, that's very interesting, and that's definitely a first. But I can see the relationship, and I can see definitely how that could help. Angela, tell us a little bit more about your current role. What falls under your purview, and maybe a little bit more about the organization.
Sure. So, I really wear three hats at Novant Health. The first hat is
that's
as
it?
A member.
Is it just three hats?
Just three hats, right? Well, I mean, broadly speaking. So the first hat is as a member of the executive team. So we have a very strong, diverse executive team. We come from a variety of backgrounds. We're not all healthcare people. Many of us have come from banking or a variety of other industries, in my case, as well as banking, retail, and logistics, and several other of my peers have also been in very different fields. So, for example, our chief medical officer, Dr. Eric Eskiaglu, is a practicing brain surgeon, but before he took up brain surgery, he was an aerospace engineer. So, you know, rocket scientist and a brain surgeon. So we have those sorts of people on staff, and it's a really fun, challenging, diverse group. And so when we make strategic decisions for the system, we leverage all that collective brain power that's around the table. And that's a full-time job, but that's just one hat. And so the second hat I wear is one in which I look after the digital capability set. So this includes our digital health line of business, as well as all of our technology, our data, our clinical informatics, cybersecurity, technical services that we provide to a variety of third parties, as well as our patient engagement group. I also co-chair the Institute of Innovation and Artificial Intelligence with our chief medical officer. And the third area of responsibility is business transformation. So we're all responsible for that, of course, but I get to lead a cross-disciplinary team that's focused on new business growth and emerging healthcare services. So it's a fun portfolio of work.
Well, that's very interesting. Definitely very three diverse hats, so to say, that you wear within the organization, but I can see how they tie together. But, you know, especially on the kind of advanced technologies, you've mentioned artificial intelligence, machine learning, all of that great stuff. That's super cool. I want to spend a little bit more talking about that. Sure. But before we dive into that, from innovation standpoint, or any specific trends and ideas that really excite you these days, whether in your industry or not, share with us what are you excited about? Perhaps what are you looking to invest in? What are you researching these days?
So generally speaking, I am most excited about our ever unprecedented access to data and our rapidly evolving ability to do something interesting with it. You know, this encompasses the world of AI and machine learning. This encompasses the world of extreme connectivity and interconnectedness. This encompasses the ways in which we're able to, in the case of healthcare, predict major health events before they happen, come to a more rapid diagnosis of a particular health health situation or health challenge, find a more appropriate personalized treatment plan for a patient. This has everything to do with how we take data that streams in from advanced sensors, and we do something with it, and we're able to provide a more meaningful and targeted and focused healthcare experience for our patients. It's the way in which we use data to better understand the social determinants of care that so often impact outcomes for our patients, and allow us to best understand how we can plug in and make a difference in that space. So, you know, everything's about data. Where it's coming from, the ability to take it in, the ability to do something interesting with it because of the ever-increasing ability to crunch that data. So it's that's the trend, and it won't slow down.
Right, absolutely. No, that's absolutely, couldn't agree with more with you in terms of the opportunities that are about to come out from, especially the times we're in, and some of the trends that you're observing, definitely relevant. When we talk about innovation, and more specifically around building and fostering that culture of innovation, or even as I, you know, I like to call that experimentation, so to say, share with us any particular strategies or practical advice that has worked well for you as an executive to really build and foster such environment of innovation within your current organization or in the past. We'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
I think we can agree that innovation should not be contained within a single organization inside of your broader company, right? We want innovation to be a way of life. Everyone does.
Right.
So what is required to make innovative thinking just part of the way you operate? First, we need to have constructs that make it easy for everyone in your organization to bring forward new ideas. Second, we need to have some bounds that are set and pre-negotiated with internal groups like legal and procurement and cybersecurity and so on and so on, so that when a new idea comes in, we don't kill that new idea before we even have a chance to do any sort of experimentation with it. And third, it is important to have those experimentation services available to anyone in your organization. So one of the things that my team does is we run an experimentation as a service model. We're able to very quickly evaluate new solutions, either that may be coming in from a third party. It may be something that we co-created with a third party. It may be something that is coming from an internal inventor. Regardless of the source, it is something that we are able to run experiments with and learn from those experiments. There is no such thing here. I'm not a big believer in the term fast fail. I'm a believer in the spirit in which that term is typically meant, which is let's learn quickly. And if a given solution is not going to be viable here, or is not going to be scalable sufficiently, or whatever, let's go ahead and just pull the plug on it before we spend too much money on it. That's what that term fast fail is meant to mean. But that is not a failure. That is the result of an experiment. You have learned from the experiment. This experiment was a success, right? And what you learned is that your hypothesis, that the solution set, whatever it was, would be viable and scalable and all the other things you need it to be, was wrong. So your hypothesis was wrong, but the experiment was a success. And we can take the learnings from that experiment and incorporate it into to what we know about our world as it exists today, which, by the way, that same experiment may produce a different outcome a year from now. So let's not say, hey, we tried it once, we ran an experiment, it wasn't going to scale, wasn't going to work for this reason or that reason or whatever. Let's add it to the collective knowledge, and then let's figure out if we need to ever revisit it and at what point we'd want to revisit that. It's at some point in the future. So there are all these constructs that I think it's so important that we make available to the team members, rather than just commanding people to go be innovative. I mean, that's not a fair request or expectation.
Right. Absolutely. I like the point of reference that you've made in terms of it's not necessarily failing fast. It's more, you know, it's learning fast, because a lot of the experimentation is all about exploring the new ways. It's understanding what works, what doesn't. It's not necessarily, let's see if it works, and if we fail, then we know that we actually tried that. That's not really the case, which especially with a lot of larger organizations, we had a very interesting case study at Harvard that we broke down on Priceline as an organization, where the culture, where they, it's a, you know, obviously technology company, and all of the code can be deployed by anybody within the organization. So it puts that accountability on everybody, you know, in the sense that if you were to deploy something and you're experimenting with something, obviously you're going to go through some research preparation and a lot of that great stuff that would, you know, minimize the risk of something going wrong, and also be able to understand whether the ROI or the impact that this particular experiment is making. So I love the analogy that you were making from kind of from that perspective. To shift the focus, you know, to topics a little bit on you, the environment we're all in these days, everyone's shifting to fully remote or hybrid work environments. I talk to a lot of executives of different organization size. I'm curious to get your take, kind of your crystal ball in terms of what is your prediction or what is your vision for that future of work? What are you planning? What are some of the things to avoid for? Obviously, you know, there's a lot of unknowns, but from your standpoint, what's the next period is looking like for you?
You know, when people ask me about the future of work, I always have to say, well, how far in the future is the future? You know, I think even the most resistant of adopters of remote work have at least been, you know, had their assumptions about remote work and its effectiveness proven to be erroneous. And that's useful because now it creates an environment in which we can talk about what's optimal, what's an optimal work environment for a given business or subline of business on a case-by-case basis. We don't have to take a stand, a philosophical stand, and fight over that philosophical stand absent data. We've essentially been forced, just as you described earlier, we've been forced into an experiment in remote working over the past year. So now we can have a conversation about what's optimal for us right now and what's optimal for us in the future. So that's been helpful. But I think when we talk about the future of work, where people work is a little less interesting to me than how they work and what they'll be doing. So for a long time, we've been talking about gig workers, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years now, we've been talking about gig workers. And we have a gig worker model at Novant Health in which we leverage a variety of students from, you know, all over the map. You know, some of these students are people who are mid-career and they're flipping careers. Others are, you know, seniors in high school. Others are somewhere in between. Some are interested parties that are closer to retirement. And we support gigs for this workforce that allows us to be very, very precise and very quick in how we turn around these little units of work. What I found is that setting up that environment is less difficult than training managers on how they allocate work assignments. So it's just the way in which we allocate work assignments down to the very lowest levels is each manager thinks about what their team has been responsible for delivering, and then they assign tasks to the members of their team. And then sometimes some of the team might include contractors, or there might be a flex model where I can carve out, you know, an outsourced piece and stick it over here with another team, internal or external. But we're not good at saying, you know what, I really don't need a senior engineer to run around and look at a lot of equipment closets to think about, you know, are these equipment closets, is everything, you know, configured the way it should be? I could probably get a junior in high school to drive around to our different locations and eyeball the equipment closets, right? And for $15 an hour instead of, you know, however much we pay our senior engineers. So we have to train ourselves to think differently about these bits of work and these units of work. And we have to start thinking about, you know, what is optimal? What does an optimal workforce look like? And then what does an optimal definition of what work is? What is that going to be? Not so much where it is conducted. It's more about how we think about the specific things that have to happen to achieve the outcomes we've been tasked with achieving. That's a mindset game. It's going to take longer to fix. Mm-hmm. Probably a few tool sets will be introduced into the mix and will help us out a little bit. You know, it's a constant evolution.
Right, absolutely. No, I love that it's not so much about the actual future work or the environment. It's about, you know, the type of skill set and how we leverage that. I think that has a lot more substance to that. And in a sense, you know, for us as a company, my base bit where I lead the technology organization, that, you know, our target kind of end user is the contingent worker. So the contingent workforce has been a very interesting trend for us to, you know, to research, develop further in terms of the functionality. And that's kind of within the lines of what you're talking about from the gig worker perspective.
Yes.
Flexibility And I get a lot of questions from, you know, I'm on the boards of a few startups and a few other companies. And sometimes the operators or the executives, they say, you know, John, you spend a lot of time talking to other executives. What are they doing in a sense, leveraging or creating that model within the organization that effectively uses that gig worker, contingent worker model? Because yes, it can be flexible, but at the same time, there's so much to that, from compliance, classification, and all of that great stuff that a lot of times go, you know, is often overlooked. So it's, you know, it's an interesting perspective that you and I can probably spend the rest of the podcast talking about this.
Well, I do want to ask you a question, because now that you bring it up, because you are an expert in this space. So one thing that I've been thinking about a lot when I think about, you know, staffing and the ways in which we grow our people and craft this culture of learning, whether they're part of the community of gig workers, which we still consider our people, even though they may work for others as well, right. Or whether they're our full-time employees in the traditional sense. I think it's more important, and I want to get your feeling on this. I think it's less important whether or not they have the five skill sets that correspond to the stack I'm using right now and the solutions I'm building, than it is for them to show that they have the capacity, the capability to evolve quickly, because I might not be using the same stack in 2 years, right? So I need them to be able to do whatever that's going to be in 2 years. So how do you think about, how do you think about screening for that ability to learn and that ability to grow?
Yeah, no, I love that topic. I love that question. And, you know, actually, talent acquisition is something that, you know, I'm very passionate about, especially from technology perspective. I would build technology around that. And one kind of the principle that I really subscribe to, and it's something that I read a long time ago in the book by Ben Horowitz, and in his book about, you know, the hard thing about the hard things. If you haven't read it, but check it out. He talks about hiring for strength versus hiring for lack of weakness. In a sense, identifying what is the particular strength that we're missing on this team. And really what you're talking about, that ability, kind of almost that inquisitiveness, that curiosity to be able to adapt to a particular environment, knowing perfectly that this technology is going to get outdated. Technology gets refreshed, renewed almost a monthly basis, as we've seen. Right. And to be able to identify those traits in the potential candidates, that they will be able to pivot, that they will actually take the proactive approach and look at some additional, you know, the forthcoming trends or the forecasts, and actually come to you with some of those, you know, proposals and recommendations. Yes. I think if you put kind of that framework in place and succeed, you're going to be so far ahead of, you know, a lot of the competition or a lot of the other, you know, the sexier brands that try to attract that type of talent, if, you know, if that makes sense, because we compete for talent, you know, it's a war out there, especially now with being fully virtual. Some of our clients said, oh, that's great. Now we're going to get full access to so much talent. No, it's actually, you know, it's actually backwards, because all of the great companies now have access to that same talent that they can probably offer, you know, what you can't. So that's just kind of my two cents into that. And I love that you bring that up from the kind of that talent acquisition standpoint. A lot of the questions from our audience, which is twofold, the executives themselves, and then we have the early stage career professionals who listen to Ivy Podcast. And a lot of times the question that I almost made that as a required question that we ask every guest is, so an interview with Angela, what does that look like? Give us a glimpse into that. And more importantly, what do you look for in some of the responses when you talk to candidates? Because you being an executive, you being kind of the top of the, you know, the technology division of your, you know, very large organization, I'm sure candidates go through multiple rounds of interviews, assessments, and so forth. But when you get to interview them, share with us any insights. What does that look like? And kind of what do you look for in when you talk to the candidates?
You know, I wouldn't have been able to articulate it so succinctly if I hadn't just had a recent conversation with my friend Peter Soul, who described three characteristics that he looks for. And I said, that's exactly what I'm looking, that's exactly what I'm trying to tease out as part of interviews, as part of, you know, when meet and greets with people, you know, of course there's, you know, whatever the domain expertise that, you know, I'm seeking is part of that discussion. But the three characteristics that Peter articulated that I'm going to shamelessly steal are, number one, curiosity. And you said it earlier, you mentioned that same exact trait a few minutes ago. Curiosity is imperative. If you're not sitting here asking yourself every single day, what am I missing? What else is out there that's interesting? You know, what else is going on? I mean, then you're going to miss all sorts of important things. So I need to make sure that the people who I bring on board are curious and will be intrinsically motivated to continue to learn. And that's true of the physicians that we hire, which are, by the way, part of my organization in some cases. That's true of the people who are doing the heavy duty cognitive computing work. And it's true of the people that are doing new business development. This is, you know, it's always about curiosity, what's next. And do I even know all the things that I'm supposed to know about what is today? The second trait is that Peter described is the belief that anything is possible. And, you know, I would probably expand that to say the ability to accept that there are many possible futures. So, because that's what we're planning for, right? Not necessarily the future that seems obvious to us, but in fact, there are many, many possible futures. So we have to be able to imagine what they all are. So I want people to think about that. I will ask them questions just to tease out whether or not they truly can see beyond the obvious and plan for it. And lastly, and this is so important, and I know you agree, it's generosity of spirit. I don't want someone coming in who believes that, I don't need someone who believes in black and white. I don't need someone who says, this is right, this is wrong. If you're wrong, you're an idiot. You know, I don't want any of those people. I want people who are going to come in and make others better. People who will have the patience to listen to different points of view, who will have the grace to learn from different points of view, and who will contribute in constructive ways to the overall team and the team's health. And that generosity of spirit is so important in every aspect of our lives. So I look for that as part of those interviews as well.
Well, I love that. And thanks for categorizing that in kind of these three very succinct and clear kind of three-prong approach, so to say, what you look for in terms of some of the candidates. And for our listeners, if you're going to be interviewing with Angela, now you have a little bit of a insider information what she looks for. But all jokes aside, I think that makes perfect sense, especially in the current environment where everything is moving, you know, so fast and the skills get advanced and the technology gets refreshed. I think it's so important to really focus on some of those areas that will really allow you to surround yourself with like-minded folks, A players, people that are smarter than us, that can come and actually tell us what to do, how to do things better, because that's, you know, that's why we hire. And for leaders, as executives, it's important to really identify opportunities where the people will succeed and put them in a position where they will be super passionate about something, where that curiosity and inquisitiveness that will go to, you know, level up 3x. So that's very interesting. In terms of kind of your strategies to attract the top talent to your organizations, to your divisions, or any particular projects that you may be leading, share with us any practical recommendations that really help you target and attract and also retain top talent, same like-minded A players.
Yeah. Okay. So those are two very different questions. So in answer to the first part of your question, which is, you know, how do we attract top talent? I have an old friend from Malaysia who used to say, it's not whom you know, it's who knows you. So it's not about me and my talent acquisition partners knowing who to call. And it's not even an executive recruiter who I might hire to do the recruiting for me. Whom do they know? This is not what's interesting. What is going to attract the talent is who knows us. Who knows us? Who knows what Novant Health is doing? Well, I hope everybody knows what Novant Health is doing. We're doing extraordinary work. We're very high growth system. We're involved in the application of emerging technologies to some of the toughest problems that we're facing in society. And we've done it successfully. We've done it before our competitors. So if you're somebody who loves making a difference, if you're somebody who loves heavy lifting, and I'm not talking about the slog kind of work, I'm talking about the really tough problems that are going to be intellectually challenging, and you're going to need to partner with a variety of third-party types and researchers and inventors and tinkerers from all over the place to find a solution that's not commercially available that will make a difference for our patients and their health, you know, I want you to come to Novant Health. And that's, we spend a lot of time talking about our work because it's important to us that people know who we are and so that they know that they will want to come work for us. So thus far, knock wood, I haven't had any problem attracting world-class talent from across many, many industries. One of the things about building a world-class team, and I've noticed this over the course of many different industries in which I've been a leader, is that when you create a talent destination, you also create a talent factory. So we have so many amazing leaders that come in and do fantastic work for us, and then they turn around and get recruited to do huge, huge things for someone else. You know, so people who come and become a VP at Novant Health are going to be recruited away to be an SVP somewhere else. Someone who comes and be an SVP for us, they're going to go be an EVP somewhere else. So that to me is not a failure. That to me is just part of being a talent destination and part of being a career maker. And that's really what we want to be.
Right, absolutely. And I think that's actually, you know, a very good point that you make when some of the, let's say, alumni or the graduates of your organization go on to take on much higher, you know, roles and responsibilities. I think that's a huge win for you. That's a huge win for your organization that you had, you know, played a significant role in putting them in that position to succeed and go to that extremely, you know, the next level. So that's, you know, I love that analogy. I love that framework in terms of looking at part of the retention strategy, so to say, that really helps people, you know, not only just to stay within an organization, but succeed in whatever the case may be for them afterwards.
That's exactly right.
So that's, I love that. I love that analogy. That's great. And Angela, last but not least, share with us your kind of the content diet, as I like to call that. What are your sources for learning? What do you consume on a daily basis? Mm-hmm. Share with us what's on your bookmarks, anything mm-hmm. that we should check out.
It's a mix. I mean, it's a mix of things. You know, I consume content very, 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 very quickly. So I read very quickly. I read a lot of things. My listening diet is more constrained because it's more time bound. You know, I can read much faster than I can listen. But I crank my listening up to usually 2x. So I can hear a little bit more.
Sounds like chip bumps.
Yeah, sometimes it does. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's a mix of news, it's economics, it's technology, it's tech innovation, it's entertainment. You know, I try to listen to a variety of things that will allow me to predict, as we said earlier, you know, what are the many possible futures we may be faced with in another year, 2 years, 3 years. It's all part of the same ecosystem. Interconnectedness of all of our fields is undeniable. So we can't just focus on one segment. Deep dive there.
For sure, for sure. And it definitely resonates with, you know, it's not so much of a lack of, you know, specific focus or attention. It's just we have so much thrown at us in terms of content and the information, you know, availability, that it becomes a challenge almost to really find your areas of interest and focus to be able to consume that in an effective manner. So that definitely resonates with kind of what you're talking about. And last but not least, what is, if you have one, one book that you absolutely love and you recommend to others? And why is that?
Well, I was really surprised by and delighted by Safi Bakal's Loon Shots this past, I guess it was, right before COVID, so maybe a year and a half ago, was published, if I'm getting my memory serves. Truly, he's either a theoretical physicist or an experimental physicist by training, but his That book is truly extraordinary. It applies how systems work to everything that we see in terms of our systems, our businesses, our society, and their receptivity or lack thereof to ideas. How, you know, what are just basically the laws? So if you think about the laws of physics, how could they be applied to things we typically don't think about as being governed by the laws of physics? And in fact, there is a correlation seemingly. So I found that to be eye-opening and also just a very enjoyable read. So I highly recommend that.
Well, that's great. I haven't read that, but definitely going to add to my growing list of books that I should definitely check out next.
You won't regret it. I can't wait to hear what you think.
Awesome. And for our listeners, we'll add the title and, you know, in the episode notes so you guys can check it out as well. Angela, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate the great insights. I know it was a very short but very powerful conversation. Personally,
it's always fun.
Definitely going to stay in touch with you. And perhaps, you know, as with all other of my guests, we can do another episode sometime next year and see how much have changed, transpired. And I definitely appreciate your time today.
Oh, that would be so fun. Thanks for having me on. It's always fun to talk with you.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.